Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Nowadays, music is so easy to carry around with us. You can hold tens of thousands of song files in the palm of your hand, and if you add an internet connection, the selection becomes basically limitless. That is, if those songs have been lucky enough to be transferred or recorded into a digital format. Today on the show, we're going to meet the folks who hunt for audio recordings that predate digital recording techniques. And we'll also learn about the latest technologies they're using to bring these rare and mostly never-before-heard sounds back to life. In our first story, Boston-based reporter Kurt Nickisch learns about a new technology that makes it possible to listen to sounds on a record without ever needing to place a needle to the groove. Here's Kurt.
In the warmly lit Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard University, researcher Mary Walker Graham is unwrapping a sealed wooden box like a gift. Inside is a sort of gift to the English language, a black record, a disc, the only one of its kind in the world.
It says in wax crayon in the center, it's written directly on the disc, Canto 56, Part 2.
It's a master recording of Ezra Pound in 1939, reading part of his epic poem, The Cantos. But the disc is falling apart.
You can see that the lacquer is beginning to come completely separated from the metal base. Once it gets to this phase, obviously it can't get anywhere near a needle. This is completely unplayable.
It's just one of thousands of archived recordings here of some of the most important poets of the recording age, T.S. Eliot, Sylvia Plath, Robert Frost. But they've been too damaged to play until today. Mary Walker Graham has always wanted to listen to a fragile T.S. Eliot recording never heard before with a written note saying, extra word at end.
Where instead of in the end of his famous poem, The Hollow Men, which everyone knows the line, the world ends not with a bang but a whimper, I had a dream that it was not with a bang but a chicken cluck. Just last night. So we'll see.
Mary Walker Graham will now be able to hear that last word thanks to a new service from the nonprofit Northeast Document Conservation Center, NEDCC, in nearby Andover, Massachusetts. The center is now offering a preservation technology called Irene to museums, archives, and private collectors.
Irene can do something that no other technology can do, which is put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
NEDCC director Bill Viette says his laboratory traditionally preserves paper documents, books, maps, photographs, often by taking high-resolution images for posterity. Now, the center has begun taking pictures of voices.
This part's easy.
Audio technician Mason Vanderloot is operating the Irene machine. It's a high-tech turntable that looks more like an industrial workbench. As the fragile record slowly spins, a 3D camera takes high-resolution pictures of the microscopic scratches etched into its grooves. Then, Vanderloot uses computer software to convert the images of the microscopic squiggles to sound. Sound that had been lost to the ages, like the one gouged side of a Robert Frost recording from around 1940.
And that's the second side of this recording where the engineer scraped out the recording so nobody would play it. And we get to go against his wishes and find out what's on it anyways.
On the gouged side of the disc is this poem.
The road's not taken. Two roads diverge in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood, looked down one.
Each time the software comes across the gouge that you can see in the image, there's a pop, but that's an accurate representation of the disc that we have.
This invention, named Irene, was inspired by a story on public radio.
And at that time, I was driving back and forth to Silicon Valley.
Carl Haber was stuck in a traffic jam listening to his local public radio station, KQED, when a story came on about the state of endangered archived sound recordings. Haber is a physicist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He was studying the surface of silicon, trying to understand its shape and how particles reacted on it.
And then I heard the thing about the sound recordings, and that idea about looking at images of particles turned into looking at images of sound. It's just one of those accidental things.
Woo! Oh, I need to speed up a little.
Now Haber's accidental eureka is creating sonic euphoria at Harvard's Woodbury Poetry Room. Researchers Christina Davis and Mary Walker Graham have been devouring all the sound from decrepit records that Irene has saved. They were delighted with poet Marianne Moore's normal speaking voice, something you never hear in commercial recordings. They recovered the only Wallace Stevens reading of It Must Change from 1954, part of his poem, Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction.
A single text, granite monotony. One soul face, like a photograph of fate.
Stevens scholar and literary critic Helen Vendler says this newly recovered recording added to her understanding of him.
It's important to hear the way he hears his own lines, because that isn't always conveyed on the page.
Among the sound recordings that have been saved is that T.S. Eliot record from 1947 with the mysterious note about the extra word at the end, the one Mary Walker Graham had been dreaming about. Here's what that extra word is.
What shall I cry? We demand a committee, a representative committee, a committee of investigation. Resign, resign, resign.
That's it. Just an accidental cut-off word at the end of the recording. It wasn't a chicken cluck, but it was close. Mundane or poetic. That's the power of this technology, unbreaking broken records. So that the fading voices of the 20th century don't go out with a whimper, but come back with a bang. I'm Kurt Nickisch.
Kurt is a business and tech reporter based at WBUR in Boston. You can listen to more of his stories on prx.org. I've also included a link to his work now up on kalw.org. Just search for The Spot. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Now, I have another take on lost recordings I want you to hear. You've learned about the latest technologies that are keeping crumbling recordings alive in a new digital era. But what can it mean culturally and emotionally to unleash these unheard sounds into a new world? In 1947, playwright and author Tennessee Williams, along with his lover, Poncho, stepped into a recording booth at a penny arcade in New Orleans and recorded 8 cardboard discs of audio content, which were considered lost until now. From their podcast, Fugitive Waves, here are the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, bringing you the story of Tennessee Williams' forgotten Pennyland recordings.
Welcome to Fugitive Waves. Lost recordings and shards of sound, along with new tales of remarkable people from around the world. We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. Today, the story of Tennessee Williams and the Pennyland recordings.
We were in the Tennessee Williams suite of the Omni Royal Hotel in the French Quarter in New Orleans for the 13th annual Tennessee Williams Literary Festival. It was 1999.
You have time or we rush for time? Why not I fix a martini and you can look at
We had back-to-back interviews lined up and were scheduled to teach a class that night. But listening back to the tape, It sounds like we took the drinks.
Here's to all of us meeting.
We talked about his clothes.
These are ballets.
It was hard not to.
Green
ballet loafers from Italy.
They hold their shape good and you can tell their quality.
And a $400 Versace silk shirt.
I saw it in Needless Markup. That's Neiman Marcus. And it goes very well with my Versace mustard color jacket.
His jewelry, a green emerald in a beehive setting, was coordinated with his shoes.
And this is a gorgeous little ring, a peridot.
His face was tan and alcoholic, his white hair receding, and he wasn't nearly as handsome as his famous brother. But if you squinted, you could see a faint resemblance.
Will you introduce yourself, say your name? And
I'm Dakin Williams, the only surviving member of the Williams family that produced Thomas Lanier Williams III. Otherwise known as Tennessee Williams. And my father called him Miss Nancy because he was sort of a sissy because he didn't play baseball like I did because he had had diphtheria as a child and he could hardly use his legs at all until he was 8 or 10 years old. And so naturally he didn't engage in baseball. He started reading books a lot too at a very young age. My mother used to censor them. And sometimes she would grab a book bunch of them by D.H. Lawrence and return them to the library and throw them on the librarian's desk and said, look what you let my son have.
We found our way to Dakin by way of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive of Recorded Sound at the New York Public Library. We were there working on a story about a rare collection of wax cylinders recorded at the Metropolitan Opera in 1901. By Lionel Mapleson, the opera's librarian. Some of the first live recordings of opera ever made. Archivist Donald McCormick closed the last of the drawers filled with fragile 100-year-old cylinders. We asked him what other secrets, what lost sounds lay in his collection. What does no one else know about but you? He stared into space. Well, there is that home recording of Angela Lansbury's audition with Jerry Herman for the role of Mame. That's high on my list, he said. And there are those 8 cardboard acetate discs made by Tennessee Williams at a Penny Arcade in New Orleans in 1947. Bingo. The discs had been donated to the library by Tennessee's longtime friends Donald Windham and Sandy Campbell. Tennessee often stayed in their tiny New York apartment, and the cardboard records were found in a footlocker under the bed filled with things he'd left behind. They had never been broadcast or heard by the public.
The following is a series of cardboard acetate discs recorded in a voiceograph recording booth at a New Orleans Penny Arcade in 1948. The label says 7A28. Streetcar, 11th scene.
Bong! Those cathedral jazz. Bong! They're the only clean thing in the quarter.
Tennessee Pancho Rodriguez and a couple of other people made in 1947 in Pennyland. They had a lot of little machines you could get, like the Lord's Prayer on a penny. And they made a record. Tennessee did some of his poetry. They did a parody from the scene of from Streetcar.
Just a boy.
6A8. Pancho singing.
Ven que estoy borracho, que voy por el mundo como alma perdida.
I'm Kenneth Holdidge. I wrote The Last Frontier of Bohemia, Tennessee Williams in New Orleans. Well, he was living with Pancho Rodriguez in 1946, 47. Their relationship, was he a flamenco dancer?
I think he and his brother Juan had an acrobatic act that the two of them did in New Orleans.
They met at a reception for Tennessee. When Tennessee returned to New Orleans from New York, he was always retreating from his success, which he could not handle gracefully. And so he fled to New Orleans after the Glass Menagerie opened. And a lot of new friends came into the picture, and among them was Pancho at a cocktail party.
6A5, Princess Interview. The speakers are Tennessee Williams and Pancho.
This is Vanilla Williams interviewing Princess Rodriguez, who just arrived here from Monterey.
Princess, what do you have to say about the trade here in this town? Now, have you gotten around much yet?
Oh, yes, I have, Manila. I have gotten around. I've been cruising on Canal Street, you know.
Oh, honey, you get off Canal Street. Miss Canal Street is no good. You should get on Miss Royal or Miss Bourbon. You should get up to the Personality Bar. It's the place for you girls.
The Personality Bar?
Yes, ma'am. No, Princess Rodriguez, you get your ass up to the Personality Bar.
I am Lyle Leveridge, the chosen biographer of Tennessee Williams. Poncho had a sense of humor. Tennessee being a sexual minority and Poncho being a Mexican, they both took their look at society as being preposterous in many ways.
Poncho was given to temper tantrums, apparently. And on one occasion, when he was angry with Tennessee and Tennessee was gone, went into the closet with the scissors and cut up all of Tennessee's clothes.
At that time, when Tennessee met him, he was writing the play Streetcar Named Desire. And in Poncho, he had a kind of a role model of the character that he would eventually create in Stanley Kowalski. And because of Poncho's dominance over him, he was playing out the role of Blanche DuBois. Even the thing about the kindness of strangers, that famous line, came out of Tennessee having said, "You bring strangers into our house." Poncho's reply to that was, "Some of my best friends were strangers."
Tennessee Williams, when did you get the idea for this play? Everybody's talking about the name of it, of course.
This play I started writing while the Glass Menagerie was running in Chicago. And after two or three weeks, I gave it up. I thought it was much too violent for the theater. I started a very quiet play after that, and whenever I'd get back in a violent mood, I'd return to work on the streetcar.
A story ripped from the fabric of life, as earthy and violent as its unforgettable star.
This record was not recorded in a penny arcade, but it was recorded in 1948. Streetcar.
Put your little foot, put your little foot, put your little foot right there.
It's 1 o'clock, and here is Mary Margaret McBride.
Tennessee Williams, his play, got absolutely good reviews from every single critic, and that's unusual this year. I like that man, too, the husband. Brando?
Marlon Brando. Marlon. He's the most gifted young actor, yes, in the New York theater.
Oh, he packs a wallop for me.
He's dynamite, he really is.
Of course, I know now there is a streetcar line named Desire.
Yes, in New Orleans they call it Desiree, the old people do.
Oh, I see.
It's French, you know. There are two streetcars that run along one track. One is named Desire and the other is named Cemeteries. So they sum up all of life on those one tracks.
Can I help you, ma'am?
Well, they told me to take a streetcar named Desire and then transfer to one called Cemetery.
His life was writing. First as telling stories, when he was a very small child in Mississippi. The older people would sit around after dinner on the porch and rock in chairs and swap stories. Then my brother would chime in with his two bits about jungles and tigers and crocodiles. And finally he'd get scared himself. He said, "It's so scary I can't go on."
He wrote 5 to 8 hours a day, usually 7 days a week. There's a wonderful passage in which he said, "I would work all morning," and that's when he was riding Streetcar, "and then spent with the rigors of creation, I would go around the corner to a bar and restaurant called Victor's, where I'd have a Brandy Alexander and eat a sandwich and listen to Inkspot's recordings on the jukebox. And then he would go over to Rampart Street and swim in the New Orleans Athletic Club, where they had an indoor pool. He swam every day."
Tennessee did the same thing all the time. He wrote. He wrote and he drank.
It wouldn't matter if he'd had a quarrel with his lover the night before and been up all night, or if he'd been out on a binge and had a hangover. He'd get up and go to his typewriter, and he broke down more machines. And when he died, they found a closet full of typewriters, and he literally pounded to death. He loved to work to music. He always had a Victrola with him. He had his little collection of records because he liked to have background music when he wrote his work. It was more than a habit, it was a compulsion. It was something he had to do, like breathing in and breathing out.
6A2. He sympathized with the persecuted Jews. The speaker is Tennessee Williams.
Jim Connor went through the world with a bang. He slammed the doors and he shouted and he sang. Nobody stopped him because nobody dared. Nobody liked him, but Jim never cared. He loved rye whiskey. He would drink it straight and he raped his woman because he couldn't wait. He shocked the neighbors. He gave them a fright when he ran out naked in the middle of the night and puked in the gutter and pissed on the lawn and sang bawdy songs till the crack of dawn. He had two sons by a beautiful wife who killed herself with a butcher's knife. One son went mad and the other went blind. In the end, Jim Connor was quiet and kind. He gave up gambling and he gave up booze. And he sympathized with the persecuted Jews. He lived to be 90 and he died in his sleep. The neighbors all gathered to pray and to weep. And his ashes they kept in a marble vase, because none of them remembered what a dirty louse he was.
About the recordings that were made in Pennyland, which still exists, by the way, on Royal Street.
My dad, Louis Boasberg, started New Orleans Novelty Company in the early 30s. Pennyland on Royal was mostly pinball games, 10 balls for a penny, quiz machines, claw machines. Fortune telling would record your voice. You'd hear the balls bouncing off the thumper bumpers and the bells ringing, fun for all.
Was asked, what first brought you to New Orleans? And he said, St. Louis, a city I loathe. I'm Kenneth Holditch, editor of the Tennessee Williams Journal. Glass Menagerie, of course, is set in St. Louis, and it is autobiographical, with the main characters being based on Tennessee, on his mother, Miss Edwina, and on his sister Rose, who lived until 3 years ago. She had a prefrontal lobotomy in the 40s, but she lived to be 87, and was the inspiration for much of his work. I think Tennessee saw a great deal of himself in Rose as he saw her deteriorate into mental disorder. He seemed to have felt that that was a possibility of something that might happen to him.
6A4, Heavenly Grass. The speaker is Tennessee Williams.
Walked in heavenly grass, all day while the sky shone clear as glass. My feet took a walk in heavenly grass, all night while the stars shone past. And my feet come down to walk on earth, and my mother cried in heavenly earth. Now my feet walk far, and my feet walk fast, but they still got to get the heavenly grass.
In heavenly grass, all day.
He did write those lyrics intended to be set to music, which Paul Bowles did. Bowles did the music for The Glass Menagerie, but he also did the music for the poems that Tennessee wrote called Blue Mountain Ballads.
Heavenly grass. My feet took a walk in heavenly grass all night while the distant stars rolled past. My feet came down and walked on earth, and my mother cried when she gave me birth.
He was a deeply religious person. He was brought up mainly by his grandfather, an Episcopal priest. The complexity of this man, his sexual nature and the rest of it, it's not cut and dried, the difference between heterosexual and homosexual. He lived in a closet, a very big closet, and he went in and out of it as he pleased. That was his lifestyle, and it worried people. There were men being imprisoned for what he was doing, picking up numbers. He could at any time have been in a place like New York City, ended up in prison, as many people were, and many careers were being broken because of this. Lyle Leveridge, author, Tom, the unknown Tennessee Williams.
Well, I'm gonna lay down.
Being from the South, having spent those very formative early years in the Mississippi Delta, which is a world of its own, I do know that Tennessee was fascinated by Elvis. And he wrote Orpheus Descending, hoping to get Elvis Presley to star in it on Broadway, and put the guitar in the play for that reason. Colonel Parker, of course, would hear none of that because they weren't going to make enough money on a Broadway show. You know, he could turn out six of those movies. Well, in this picture of Tennessee and Elvis that Dick Levitt sent me, Tennessee is looking up at Elvis like a little puppy dog or something.
They met in Hollywood. Tennessee was out there for the filming of Suddenly Last Summer, and Presley was making one of his movies. He played a soldier in it. And I saw that photograph, and I said, I don't believe the look on your face when you're meeting Elvis Presley. He said, oh, he said, I think he's wonderful. He said, he's a great actor.
Johnny Mohegan, Joanna Alvarez, and Tennessee Williams singing Down in the Valley.
Trio, Down in the Valley.
Down in the valley.
If I didn't care more than words can say, if I didn't care.
Tennessee Williams and the Pennyland Recordings was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to Irene Herman for permission to use the music Paul Bowles composed for Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie. Thanks to Randy Tom for Musical Fire. You've been listening to Fugitive Waves from the Kitchen Sisters, stories from the flip side of history, produced in collaboration with Tom Corwin.
If I didn't care, would it be the same?
Fugitive Waves from the Kitchen Sisters is part of Radiotopia, an independent network of story-driven podcasts and radio shows. You can find more stories from Fugitive Waves, as well as a link to subscribe to the podcast, online now at radiotopia.fm. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.